of you. I'm gonna mash potatoes. I'm gonna start by going to New York City, which is number one.
I'm David Cohn. This is the World Science Podcast. It's June 26, 2009. We're coming to you from The World, which is a one-hour daily international news magazine airing on public radio stations across the U.S. It's co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can find out more at theworld.org. This music that we're listening to is Mashed Potatoes USA by James Brown. This week, we have a special show that's almost completely about food. We're going to talk with Harvard anthropologist Richard Wrangham. He's the author of a new book called Catching Fire, which argues that cooking is the key technology that allowed us to become human. Wrangham has spent decades doing research on primates in Africa. He says cooking gave us access to a wider range of foods, helped our brains grow, and because we no longer had to eat berries and leaves for 6 hours a day like our ancestors, gave us leisure time to develop tools and technology. He's got some really unexpected ideas. He's got a lot to say about how the explosion of soft food plays a crucial role in today's obesity epidemic, how cooking led to the subjugation of women, and about his own experience eating raw meat and leaves like chimpanzees do. And, starting today, Professor Wrangham will be appearing in our online interactive science forum. A lot of adjectives there. And in fact, I just checked, and he has already made some comments. You can ask him questions. You can offer your take on food and evolution, exchange your favorite zebra and gazelle recipes. And Professor Wrangham will regularly check in, commenting and responding to what you say. It's all at theworld.org/science. Again, theworld.org/science. Let's get to this interview. Thanks a lot, Richard, for talking to us.
A great pleasure to be here today, David.
Your basic theory is that cooking is what made us human. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, we all know you are what you eat, and the question is, what is it about what we eat that is really special? And in the case of humans, it is undoubtedly cooking. Cooking is the signature feature of the human diet. And what we've discovered in the last few years is that although, of course, we can eat lots of foods raw, and although every other animal survives well on raw food, humans really do seem to be special because we cannot survive really effectively on raw food. The only exception is modern urban society, where you can have access to very high-class agricultural domesticated foods. But for people living in a state of nature, as it were, I mean, hunters and gatherers living in the wild, there's no evidence at all that we can survive on raw food. And what this means is that humans are fundamentally adapted to cooking as a part of their existence. So we are the cooking animal. And then the fascinating question is, how long has this been going on?
I think that you say that humans began cooking 1.8 million, almost 2 million years ago. And as I understand it, the archaeological evidence for fire goes back only 800,000 years. So how do you go back that extra million years?
So the archaeologists are just unable to help, really, with this. What they don't show is any kind of threshold. You know, you see the record of the control of fire just trickling back, dying out, and there's no point at which you suddenly say, oh, yeah, here it is. I mean,
right.
That 800,000-year mark is the only one at that age, and then earlier it's more like 500,000. So the biology consists of much stronger evidence because the reason that we are restricted to a diet that includes a lot of cooked foods is because we have evolved to have a tremendous reduction in various aspects of our intestinal system. And it starts with the mouth. We've got a tiny little mouth compared to other great apes.
Hmm.
We have small teeth. And we have small guts overall. I mean, our guts are the smallest in relationship to our body size of any of the primates.
Now, how does that work? When you say gut, that's intestines and stomach, that whole apparatus, right?
Yeah, the stomach itself, the small intestine, the long tube that goes on from the stomach and actually is responsible for almost all our digestion, and the large intestine, the colon, which is tiny compared to other non-human primates. Once we started eating cooked food, then it was a great saving to the body in terms of energy to be able to get rid of the intestine that you didn't need. And we didn't need it because our food was high density and very easily digested once we started cooking.
So then what happens that you get a smaller gut, and I think the argument that you put forth in the book is that as your gut shrinks, you can take that energy that was going into digestion and put it into your brain. Is that right?
Well, yes, but let's just deal first of all with the evidence that the gut tells you about when cooking started.
Okay.
So we now have these characteristic features compared to other non-human primates, the small mouth, the small teeth, the small gut. And we can pinpoint when these things evolved because the fossil record tells us when we had small mouths, when we had small teeth, and when our guts became small, to judge from the reduced flaring of the ribs and the reduced width of the pelvis. And the answer is this happened with the evolution of Homo erectus between 1.8 and 1.9 million years ago. I mean, it's a signal that is really quite strong, and it's very difficult to imagine how that species, Homo erectus, could have had these reductions in the gut unless they had such good food processing that basically they had to cook.
What's the difference in terms of nutrition and digestibility between raw food and cooked food? What is that sort of quantum leap?
This is
mean?
An extraordinary thing, I think. Here is cooking, the most characteristic feature of the human diet. And until now, we have not had a theory about what cooking does. And the evidence that I've turned up is that cooking very consistently increases the amount of energy that we get out of the diet. So the answer to your question is calories. If you take a pound of raw steak and you eat that and you compare it with the effect of eating a pound of cooked steak, then you are going to get significantly extra calories out of eating the cooked steak. And it doesn't matter whether it's steak or carrots or veg or seeds, whatever it is. Cooking increases the energy you get out of your food.
Really interesting. So it's a quantum leap that you're talking about here in terms of the amount of energy that you can get from the food.
Yes, I mean, we certainly can't quantify it accurately. And in fact, our current food labeling system gives up completely on the attempt to quantify it, so that if you look in the official records, the official tables of nutrient composition, they will tell you that the number of calories in raw meat is the same as the number of calories in cooked meat. But that's wrong, and that's what I review in the book, because there are all sorts of processes that basically boil down to a lot of physical processes that our current labeling system does not acknowledge. It all acknowledges the chemical processes. That is to say, you know, how much of the carbohydrate and protein and fat and so on you have in the food. It doesn't think about how it's packaged, but the packaging turns out to matter enormously. And if you have something that is soft, as cooking softens things, for instance, then the fact of it being softer means that it's easier to digest and you get more net calories out of the food because your body is paying fewer calories to digest the food.
So the actual digestion, really, you're burning a fair number of calories if you're eating a lot of celery or something that's hard to digest.
It takes bodily energy to digest any food. And the less it is processed, the less it is cooked, or the bigger particle size, then the greater the energy it takes. But it was still true that we have much less information about this than we would like. The information that we've got largely relies on studies of other animals, and only occasionally do you have studies of humans themselves. But for instance, we've done studies with pythons. And with pythons, if you take meat and you grind it, then it reduces the cost of digestion by about 12%. If you cook it, it also reduces the cost of digestion by 12%. But if you cook it and you grind it, you know, like a hamburger,
right,
then you reduce the cost of digestion by almost completely adding them up. It's 23%.
Wow.
You see in hunters and gatherers that they have kind of figured this out, because not only do they cook their meat, but very often they then pound it. They understand that a hamburger is what you really want to eat.
Now tell me this. How did you come up with this idea? You were in front of a fire, I believe. Tell me about that.
Well, I was in front of a fire when I finally got the idea, but it started for me when I used to follow chimpanzees from dawn till dusk. And in the days of my youth, I would sometimes do it without taking any food with me. Maybe I just got up late or whatever.
Wow.
And
wow.
So then I would, I'd try and eat the chimpanzee foods. And then it became a thing for me to just see, could I survive eating the chimpanzee foods as I was following the chimpanzees?
And so what are chimpanzee foods, though? I don't know what that is. You got to tell me.
Well, a lot of them are fruits. I mean, you could kind of imagine going into a northern forest in America or Britain or something like that.
Okay.
And looking for the fruits that you find there. Now, you do not find apples and oranges and bananas. You know, what you find are wild cherries with just a little bit of pulp around a large seed. or you find rose hips, very dry fruits, nothing fleshy and exciting about them at all.
Right.
Most of the chimpanzee fruits are like that. And frankly, there are very few indeed that you can eat more than one or two of them without feeling sick. And the notion of filling your stomach with them and then doing the same thing again an hour or two later, which is what chimpanzees do, is just simply overwhelming. I mean, you couldn't do it.
Right.
Now, I wondered at the time, is this just because I've got a refined, luxurious Western taste, and I've got used to cooking, and if I really was up against it, maybe I would be prepared to eat this stuff and survive on it.
Right.
So then I went and checked with all sorts of people, hunters and gatherers living in the wild, and people who are cast away and don't have fire, and how they survive. And I could not find any case where anybody had ever survived for a long time on raw food in the wild. That was, the early 1970s that I started thinking about this, but the penny did not drop until about 10 years ago when I, as you say, I was sitting in front of the fire and I thought, I was preparing a lecture on human evolution, and I was trying to think to myself, now, how long ago is it before humans, if we go back into the past, would not have been able to sit around like I was around the fire and eat their food? And as I thought about my difficulties of eating chimpanzee foods, and surely the difficulties that any of our ancestors would have felt the same way with our small stomachs and so on, the penny really dropped for me, and it seemed to me that we have this problem. We know that cooking came in sometime. Hmm. It seems like a huge influence. It seems like a wonderful benefit to our feeding, and it should have had big impacts on our evolution. So when did it happen? And as you go back further in time, it's impossible to imagine it happening any time until the point at which we became human.
So it's the linchpin for you. Now, you did another experiment, too, which was that you... chimpanzees, when they're eating raw meat, raw meat is very tough, I guess, when you don't grind it up. And so they chew it with leaves to do something with it. And you actually tried that with raw goat meat. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very struck by the fact that raw meat is not something that is a really very high-class food from the point of view of chimpanzees. I mean, they certainly love it, and they tend to finish completely the carcasses of the prey animals that they kill.
Right.
But it is difficult doing it. They chew and they chew and they chew. One of the things that they do when they eat meat is they always take a tree leaf and add it to their meal and chew with that. And people have often wondered what this is all about, and they sometimes think, well, maybe it's something about the tannins in the leaves or the proteins in the leaves. But I was struck by the fact that sometimes these leaves are just dead leaves, so there's absolutely nothing sort of chemically significant about them at all. And I developed the idea that what they're doing is finding a primitive way to process the food so that you can chew it more easily, so that maybe it gives a bit of a grip on this slippery meat that is so difficult to chew.
It gives it some traction, I guess, is what
exactly,
you're saying.
Exactly, exactly. Gives it traction and enables you to chew faster.
So what does it taste like?
Well, of course, I suppose it depends on the leaf. I tried it with avocado leaves, being a bit of a wimp. I didn't try one of the sort of potentially poisonous leaves in the forest.
Right.
But
no dead leaves for you either.
Yeah, so we had a sort of chocolate and whiskey party with some friends, and they were promised the chocolate and whiskey if they would do this. And
right.
We all ate some. We chewed some raw meat, and I used goat meat from Africa, where the goats are just out there every day and pretty tough.
Right.
And so we chewed it raw, and then we chewed it raw with leaves and without leaves, and we spat the results into tubes, and then I analyzed them. And when we had been chewing the meat with leaves, then the lump of meat got eroded twice as fast as the lump of meat when we were not chewing it with the presence of leaves. So I think this is one of the earliest ways of food processing.
Now, one thing you talk about in the book is that you theorize that cooking has likely played a major role in the subjugation of women.
Well, obviously this is speculative stuff, but
right.
There are fascinating kind of connections between cooking and society, and some of them are very charming and delightful. I mean, you know, we all have that sense of companionship around the fire, and companion means with bread. It's associated with eating.
You mean the word literally means companion? You're right. It literally means with bread.
Yeah. The Latin derivation, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, there's all sorts of these associations. The food writer Michael Simons calls cooking the starting place of all trades. But many of us have this feeling that cooking is associated with all of this generosity and this sharing. But I think there is a darker side to it as well. Now, this is represented by cross-cultural surveys that show that in all societies except modern urban industrial society, it is absolutely routine for women to do the domestic cooking. They cook for the men. And you might think that this is simply a very companionable arrangement in which women and men give each other something. But what is so striking is that women don't always want to do the cooking. They would like a little bit more help than they get. You know, I mean, I tell the story in the book of this study by Maria Lepowski of a people that she reckoned were the most egalitarian on earth. You know, this is the place where women, as much as anywhere on earth, can hold the same political power as men and can go on raids with the men and can own all the stuff that men can own. And there seem no limits to what they can do. So then I thought, okay, well, let's find out about the cooking. And guess what? You know, the women not only do the cooking, but they're the ones who have to pick up the pig droppings and all that sort of stuff.
They have to do the dishes. How did cooking become women's work?
I think what's going on is that the emergence of cooking, this enormously valuable addition to our skill set, meant that everybody benefited from eating cooked food, men and women. And maybe you can imagine that the males and the females were all individually cooking for themselves at first. But it would rapidly have emerged to the males the idea that, hey, you know something? If I come back hungry and not having got my food together for the day, I can bum off some woman.
Right.
And the reason they can do that is because when you have cooking, you have for the first time an absolute necessity for the food to remain in the sight of everybody else while it is being prepared. You cannot simply put all the food into your mouth straight away because obviously then it wouldn't be cooked.
Right.
So this creates a problem. It creates an opportunity for theft. And it sounds a sort of very stark thing when we think about human morals, but you know, humans are prepared to pinch things from each other unless there are very clear social rules. And I think what's happened is that this exposure to theft as a consequence of cooking really sort of necessitating ownership has led to the development of a primitive protection racket. You know, women can nowadays return as hunters and gatherers from all their hard work in the bush and unsling their carass and drop their food's in camp, and they can be very confident that no one is going to try and take any food from them. And the reason is because they are married to someone who, if she says to him, you know what, that nasty bachelor came along and started pestering me, and when my back was turned, he took some of my food, the husband can say to all the other men, we have a problem, guys. That bachelor needs to be taught a lesson.
It's kind of a brutal setup that you're describing, in which they are receiving protection and in exchange they have to do a bunch of work.
Yeah, exactly. She is vulnerable, so it ends up with she feeds him and what she gets out of it is security. And by the way, the reason that this is possible is because of some other aspect of cooking, which is that because cooking softens our food, we eat it incredibly fast compared to every other animal. Chimpanzees, they spend something like 6 hours a day just chewing their food.
My God, you're kidding. 6 hours a day. So a big chunk of their waking life is spent just chewing food.
Yeah, and another big chunk of it is spent resting after they've eaten, you know, in that postprandial sense of exhaustion or fatigue.
It's a lot of work to eat this food.
That's right. Your body is working hard. So, you know, the oxygen is no longer going off to the peripheral tissues. It's going into the gut and you feel sleepy. And very often what a chimp does is it has a big meal, an hour of chewing fruits up in the tree, and then it comes down and lies on the ground, has a little bit of grooming session and goes to sleep.
Wow.
And so... Yeah. They're spending 6 hours a day chewing plus an hour or two a day just resting in between times. Now,
so rough food is exhausting.
Raw food is exhausting for the stomach, that's right, and it's time-consuming. And because it's time-consuming, you could not imagine a system of the males doing not much eating by day and then coming back and having their big meal at night, because it just wouldn't happen. They'd be eating until 2 or 3 in the morning. So it's only when you cook that a man can come back and know that it's worthwhile to expect his wife to have food for him, because now he can eat it in 40 minutes and still be satisfied.
So it also frees up a huge amount of time to do other stuff, to sit around and think about coming up with new weapons, new tools, new ways of killing mammoths. Suddenly, when you cook, the whole structure of your life changes completely.
It really does.
Now, you also talk about the modern epidemic of obesity may be related to the explosion of these softer processed foods. Tell me a little bit about that.
For me, one of the classic experiments in this field is one done by a Japanese team of dentists, actually, who were able to isolate the effect of softness on the net energy gain. And they did this by feeding rats with two kinds of laboratory chow. The one kind was the same that they always eat, and the other was exactly the same stuff, which had been changed in a simple way. They added air. And so they had the same calories per nugget and the same water content per nugget and the same everything. It was just puffed up. It was like a little bit of puffed wheat compared to a regular wheat.
Right.
And so it was softer to chew. And they fed these things to the two groups, and they monitored how much they ate, and they ate the same amount. They monitored how much they spent on locomotion, and that was the same too. So the only difference was that the food was softer. And guess what? The ones eating the softer food grew faster, and they had 30% more body fat.
Whoa.
So a lot fatter, just because the food was softer. And they could even tell exactly where this came from. It came from the reduced cost of digestion, because they could monitor the metabolic rate after a meal, and when they ate the softer food, the rats had a lower rate of metabolism. So this seems to me to be potentially a fascinating model for thinking about the fact that we have an obesity crisis, but in addition, over the last decades, over the last century, our food has become increasingly finely processed. It is softer all the time. We have Twinkies instead of whatever the equivalent of Twinkie was 50 years ago.
Right. We're eating a lot of mush.
Yeah. I mean, a loaf of bread now is softer than it would have been decades ago.
So in a way, the raw foodists, as I guess they're called, they have a point. It's not they're wrong in that that's what our ancestors ate, but they're right in that if you eat that way, you might lose weight because it's tough to digest that stuff.
That's right. I mean, the raw foodists have this ironic thing that they say. They say, we eat raw food and we feel so much more vital. You know, we're full of vitality. We're full of energy. Well, you know, so that's a kind of wonderful irony, because they're not full of energy. They've actually got less calories. But you can see how they might feel more energetic, because this is a healthier diet.
Right.
In many ways, particularly if you're overweight. And so you're going to end up carrying less of the burden of too much fat around on you.
What do you like to eat?
You know, I'm a great admirer of the raw foodist, and if I had a stronger will, I would probably be more of a raw foodist myself. But I am pretty much a regular American diet, although I've seen chimpanzees.
So a regular American diet, what that means to me is you go to McDonald's 2 or 3 times a week.
Okay, maybe it's not such
a
regular diet.
You go to KFC a few times a week.
I don't eat red meat. Okay. I've seen chimpanzees tear apart enough animals brutally that vision comes to me when I have red meat. And I don't want to be responsible for killing animals. I try and have something a bit like the South Beach diet, actually, you know, light on fats and light on meats and lots of veg.
Are you a good cook? Do you cook at all?
I'm a lousy cook. I like to cook occasionally, but I'm pretty scared of offering what I cook to anybody else.
And who does the cooking in your house then? That implies that it's maybe your wife.
Well,
true,
yes, you know, it's true, you know. I'm one of those awful people who exploits my wife. But being aware of this, I do try and compensate. And actually,
you do the dishes, right?
Exactly.
There we go. All right, that's something. That's something. That's about what it is like in my house, too. I get some grief for that, but I do the dishes.
There you go. Well, we can be better men.
Yeah. All right, well, this was great, Richard. I had a great time talking. It's Richard Wrangham, who's the author of a new book, Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. Thanks a lot, Richard.
Thanks a lot, David, and see you in cyberspace.
And now for a weekly rundown of some other science headlines with Elsa Youngstead. Elsa will be gone for the next 2 weeks on vacation, so savor the news this week. Hey, Elsa, let's start with kangaroos.
Hey, David. Not just kangaroos, but giant kangaroos that went extinct about 45,000 years ago in Australia, along with most of the other large mammals there. Researchers now say they have new evidence that it was humans who hunted giant kangaroos to extinction.
Now, how giant were these guys exactly?
6 feet tall and 500 pounds.
Wow, 500 pounds. That's a big kangaroo. How far could they jump?
That I don't know, but they were well over twice as big as the very biggest modern kangaroo, so they probably made a thump when they landed.
And based on this new study, I guess they must have been pretty tasty, too.
Yeah. Apropos of Richard Wrangham, I guess you could say that people's taste for cooked meat is what did in the giant kangaroos. Some researchers have thought this for a while, but there's also been a big debate, and people have argued that it was climate change or that maybe it was people burning off the habitat where the kangaroos lived.
So this study found clues to the extinction in the kangaroo's teeth.
The researchers looked at microscopic patterns of wear on the kangaroo teeth from giant kangaroos that were in museums, and they compared the giant kangaroos to other kangaroos and wallabies, to ones that ate grass and to ones that ate shrubbery.
So wear from grass and wear from shrubs is different somehow.
Right. Grass scratches the teeth and shrubs pit the teeth. So the giant kangaroos had more pits, therefore they must have eaten trees and shrubs. And based on the chemistry of their teeth, the researchers think they probably ate specifically saltbush.
And that's the key to this puzzle, I guess.
If they were eating saltbush, the climate change and burning theories don't work as well. Saltbush is really hard to burn. It's not flammable. So that eliminates the idea that people burned off the habitat. And saltbush also thrives in hot, dry climates. Plus, the kangaroos had also survived earlier droughts just fine. So that kind of eliminates the climate change possibility, too.
So it comes down to hunting, then. Humans ate the giant kangaroos to extinction.
And they probably did the same thing to other large Australian mammals that went extinct around the same time. Things like the marsupial lion and a wombat that was as big as a hippopotamus.
Wow, I'd love to see an artist rendering of those guys. Our next story is also about large extinct mammals, dinosaurs in this case. Turns out that they're much smaller than we thought.
Yeah, it's kind of disappointing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all about statistics and how treacherous they are. Since the 1980s, a lot of scientists have used this one equation to calculate dinosaurs' weight.
And that equation was based on the leg bones of a bunch of mammals of various kinds of different sizes.
Right, 33 species, from mice to elephants and hippos, and scientists use this equation to extrapolate dinosaur weight based on their leg bones.
So what's the problem?
Well, it's a fairly subtle sort of problem. You might have to say a lot about statistical transformation and residuals and homoscedasticity.
I'm a big fan of homoscedasticity.
Oh, so am I, but I still don't really want to talk about it right now. In the original study, the scientists had missed some weird things about their data, and it turned out that their equation didn't pay enough attention to the large animals like the hippopotamus and the elephant, and it was maybe more accurate for the small animals, which is a bad thing if you're doing calculations for something that's really huge, like Tyrannosaurus rex.
So what happened in this paper is the researchers came up with a new equation, I bet.
Which says that dinosaurs probably weren't as heavy as the original equation predicted. Maybe only half as big, some of them. The Apatosaurus, for example, downsized from 38 metric tons to only about 18 with this new equation.
Which is still huge. I just want to point that out. So were the dinosaurs skinny like giraffes? Is that what it comes down to?
Well, I haven't seen an artist rendering of the new skinny dinosaur either. But if it's half as big as we're used to seeing, it would probably look pretty skinny.
I guess they didn't eat as much as we thought they did. Let's stay with food. In honor of Richard Wrangham, let's do one more about prehistoric food. This story is about the origins of agriculture in the Middle East.
The anthropologists found grain storage buildings that are more than 11,000 years old. They found these in Jordan near the Black Sea.
Now, domesticated plants don't show up until about 1,000 years later. So this is right. The oldest evidence of grain storage ever.
Well, the oldest really solid evidence, at any rate. Scientists have thought that food storage would be an important prerequisite for agriculture because storing your food year-round, even when a particular grain was out of season, you would have a food supply, and that would allow people to establish permanent communities, to settle down, and then they would be able to stay in one place and breed domestic plants, too. But evidence for this early food storage has been hard to find.
So how do the researchers know these buildings were granaries?
Several ways. The granaries were next to buildings that contained stone grinding tools, which looked kind of suspicious, and they were round with raised floors that would have protected the grain from moisture and from rats. And then the granaries also had microscopic particles from wild barley inside of them.
An early chapter in the cultural shift from hunting and gathering to farming. Mm-hmm. Sounds pretty good. Now, you are off to Bulgaria for 2 weeks. What do they eat there? It's sort of like Greek food, I think, right?
Sort of. You have yogurt soup, grape leaves, stuffed cabbage. No kangaroo, but I'll let you know when I get back what I ate.
Now, if you see kangaroo on the menu there, don't order it. That's my advice to you.
Although, given my Bulgarian language skills, I'm not sure I'd recognize it on the menu, but, you know.
All right. Well, have a good time in Bulgaria. And
thanks.
We'll see you in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, whatever it is. Have a good trip. We'll miss you.
Okay. Thanks, David. We'll see you soon.
That was Elsa Youngstedt, who helps edit science news at Sigma Xi, the Scientific Research Society. She's talking to us from Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Now, remember, starting today, Richard Wrangham will be appearing in our interactive science forum. You can ask him questions, offer your take on food and evolution, exchange your favorite zebra, frog, gazelle, and giant kangaroo recipes. And Richard will regularly check in, commenting and responding to what you say. Now, if you have anything else to say to us, what we should cover, what we shouldn't cover, what you think of what we're doing, email us at david.kohn@bbc.co.uk or go to theworld.org/science. We're on Facebook, The World Science Podcast, and we're tweeting almost constantly. So check it out. Start following us, World SciPod, WORLDSCIPOD. That's it for this week. Take care.
Support for the World Science Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and the Amgen Foundation, which seeks to advance science education, improve access to care, and strengthen Amgen's communities. More at amgen.com.